Okay. So what happens is this is a two-step process. First, we measure the blank, and we can store the profile for later replication in a database in the computer. And then we can tell it to mill the blank. There's about five different sizes of blanks to basically do any key. And so a little milling head comes out, and it laterally mills the blank. Most profiles can be copied unless they're square-cut profiles, as shown on the right-hand side. It won't do squares. And it won't do protrusions. Now, the cool thing about this machine is that you can take a change key. Now, think about this in the master key environment when you can't get the blanks. This is the problem with this machine. If you have access to the machine and you have access to a change key but not a blank key, this machine will replicate the change key and change it into a blank key. So you have no access problems for the blank keys. This is why this whole master keying issue has become so critical. And again, here's what the blanks look like, and here's what the cut keys look like. And what it does is it actually samples and approximates the wards in the lock, so it doesn't absolutely precisely represent the key. Now, what's really cool about this machine, I've been working with the manufacturer in Germany. There's now software out for this machine that you can take a photograph of a keyway. You gotta love science. Okay, so we take a picture of the keyway, import it into Adobe Photoshop, size it, import it into the Easy Entry, and what you do, I don't know if you can see a little bit, you actually draw the keyway. You draw it the way you want it to be, and then you store it in a database, and you replicate the keyway. And then now you have a blank key that fits the lock. Now, you may have some special requirements. Let's talk about our friends at Schlage. Now, this is the database, how you store the profile, and then you can modify it. You can make it thinner. You can make it thicker. You can chop pieces off. You can add pieces. You can change sectional keyways in high-security environments. You can do whatever you want. So, here's our friend, Mr. Everest. This is an original Everest profile, and you can see how the undercut would prevent a standard blank from entering that keyway, which is its very clever design and patented. And if you're not able to have that undercut, you aren't getting into that keyway. Now comes the modified profile, and as you can see, what I did was I drew around the undercut. So this is now not a Schlage Everest blank. This is one that will open this lock, and then my friend Ken Pearson at Peterson Manufacturing that makes the lock picks, he made a little pin that inserts into the lock and raises the check pin. So it's very clever. So that's basically the machine. They have a website, easyentry.de, if you want more information on it. Impressioning notes, as I said. You can open, as I found, with a ballpoint pen, the locks for the computers. Thank God nobody steals computers today, or that wouldn't have much effect. This is a foil impressioning system that's made by John Fall, as I mentioned. And basically, you stick an aluminum foil carrier into the lock, and in 30 seconds, this is a Schlage 923C, which Matt talked about. It's open. And by the way, the two books that Matt talked about, written by Hobbs, and then there's another one written by George Price and Art of Manipulation are all in the CD. Yep, okay. And this is what the foil carrier looks like after its impression. It's very clever. And you can actually decode that foil carrier and come up with a code number for the key. This is another method of opening foil, aluminum foil with the dimple keys like Barry's going to show you. And I'll turn it over now to Mark, and if we have time at the end, we'll talk about Antwerp a little more. Thank you.
Appreciate it. sometimes it takes a little.
Can't you get it?
Sometimes it takes a little.
Oh, let's see. How do you do that with it? I had this problem in Germany.
Yep.
Okay.
You got it.
Okay.
Hi there. My name's Mark Seiden, and I do physical security for a living. I break into things. Always when authorized, I usually require written permission. So I'm not going to repeat the stuff that these other fine people have said. I'll try to skip over. I have way too many slides because I was invited only yesterday. I'd like to step back a bit, though, and look at the bigger picture here, which is not focusing on locks, but focusing on the system issues. Locks are just one component which fit in into a gestalt which most manufacturers don't even bother to understand. The users who install also don't bother to understand the context in which the lock or the things around it are installed. So this fits in a much bigger context of physical security, which has been getting smaller and smaller since 9/11, and a number of features in the enterprise environment, in the business environment, have been reducing physical security, specifically, for example, reliance on external parties, outsourcing and offshore development. That means you're depending on all these, and co-location sites. This means you're depending on all these external people to do the security for you rather than doing it yourself. Even in the enterprise, if you work in a business, you'll discover there's fragmented responsibility and authority between sysadmin and networking and legal and facilities, and often there are multiple sites, so there are different people in different locations that have responsibility for stuff. And there's a lot of gaps between these competing parties, so stuff will just fall into the cracks. There's very little budget for remediation of older facilities, problems with older facilities, like locks that were installed 35 years ago. Mostly, the risk management mindset is insurance-oriented. You know, what do we stand to lose? How do we buy insurance to pay us for the loss, to cover us for the loss? Another problem is that the facilities people who have lots of functional power, they have this key ring, which can open anything, have very little status. So they might be in a cube instead of in a locked office. Moreover, they have very little training in how to make buying decisions, so the vendors sell them snake oil or products that don't work very well. Meanwhile, almost no solutions are open source. It's really hard to evaluate what the vendor products are unless you're somebody like Mark Tobias or you buy his book. And they see, I'm even plugging his book. So the other problem, as Matt has pointed out, is that they strongly believe in security through obscurity. Their common cop-outs, rationalizations, excuses are, that's not my job, it's my vendor's problem, I don't consider that a plausible threat, we just have to do a little bit better than locks and keys, or we have to raise the bar just a few inches so they'll go to our neighbors. In a campus or a building, there's a lot of legacy to deal with. For example, partial height walls, hung ceiling, raised floor, wiring rooms in the wrong places like in the hallways, wire runs through public areas, doors that were installed 30 years ago, locks that are misinstalled. Now, at least you can ask yourself in the physical security world, is there a perimeter? You can't ask that in the networking context anymore because of wireless. Then there are, in the physical security world, there are also these backdoors, and I don't mean the physical backdoor to the plant where the people go outside and smoke, but that is one of them. There's also the Knox box. It's this little box that sits on the side of your building and has the keys inside it, and there's a single key that all the firefighters and police officers have that opens that Knox box, and they take out the key ring, which opens the inside. So if they need to get in case of emergency, that's what you call in computer science a single point of failure. The Knox box is usually protected by a Medico cabinet lock. Another physical security problem in campuses or buildings is the local operating networks. That is, the building control is on a network itself. Usually it runs on power line or some other kind of network, and often these things are connected with the enterprise network. Sometimes these things also control the doors and the alarms. Multi-tenant buildings are a special problem because they have shared infrastructure, and there's a lowest common denominator factor that comes in because the weakest tenant security policy probably is your de facto security policy. If they let anybody in, anybody can walk up to your front door. So co-location facilities are one of my favorites. I'm often hired to test the security at colos. And these are like gated communities, except when the motorcycle gang moves in down the street, you've lost all your security. Your co-tenant's weakest visitor and vendor policy puts you at risk. So let's get down to components now. There are things like doors, which are made of what? Are they single or double doors? Where are the hinges? Sometimes they're on the outside. Sometimes you can just take hinge pins off the doors. Then there are locks, pardon the ends. This is a PowerPoint wonderfulness. All these guys talk about locks. A few amusing problems with locks are that the best-selling tubular locks, Schlage, have deadlockers, which are rendered ineffective by the biggest-selling electric strikes. These are often installed together, and the deadlocker just slips into the gap behind the electric strike. So you can just push back the bolt. The deadlocker doesn't work. I frequently see exposed electric strike wiring outside the protected area. Magnetic strikes, which are those things with the big magnets, not on uninterruptible power. And it's little realized that adhesive tape on the magnetic strike or any kind of coating reduces the holding strength dramatically according to an inverse cube law. Matt had some mathematics, so I have to have some mathematics too. Now, so key locks are often installed even on doors controlled by badge access control, so you have a parallel, weaker system by which you can get through. And often nobody knows who has the key to the key locks on the magnetic on the doors controlled by the badge access system. So I won't talk about any of these lock cylinder issues because everybody else has, except for interchangeable core cylinders. Interchangeable core cylinders have a special key called a control key, which you can use to remove the core and replace it with a different core. In other words, rekey the lock quickly. The problem is that the control key is often even more universal than any master key. There's one control key for the whole system. And you can make a control key with one instance of a lock. One comment on Mark's description of systems that avoid the master keying vulnerability that Matt described is that you can still take apart any instance of any of these locks and figure out what the sidebar combination is. So, I mean, it leaves a trace. There's a hole in the door. Some lock has disappeared. Maybe a padlock has walked off. But you still only need one lock to reverse engineer the entire system.
Mark, let me just make one comment. That's true if one sidebar code is used in the whole system. That is not true, as I said, if there's multiple sidebar codes that Medico and ASA have the capability of developing or generating, which no other system does. If you take a target lock with a different sidebar code than what you're going after, you aren't going to open it.
Okay.
That's
good.
The problem.
Thank you. The real problem with physical locks is that revocation of rights is unacceptably difficult and expensive. I learned to pick locks at Columbia University in the 1960s so that I worked for the radio station there, and we wanted to report on kids getting beat up by cops on campus, and we didn't want to get beaten up or tear gassed ourselves. So I made keys to the tunnels under the campus and the building so we, the radio station, could report on what was going on. I went back for my 25th college reunion.
So in other words, you are a terrorist.
That's right. I was a terrorist.
Okay. But now sounds like Les Miserables.
I'm a grandpa terrorist. So when I went back for my 25th reunion, guess what? My tunnel keys and my front door keys to the building still worked 25 years later. So this is just a demonstration that revocation of rights is seldom, if ever, done because it's enormously expensive. So what do we use instead? We use computer access badge systems. So there's a computer and a database involved. I can hear you saying, uh-oh. It's wired somehow to microcomputer-based panels with local caches of access rights. And these things used to be connected on local wiring, point-to-point wiring, but now they've networked it all. And how have they networked it? They put these Lantronix terminal controllers in front of it. They use bogus proprietary protocols. They seldom use mutual authentication of the counterparties in any transaction. So you can do man-in-the-middle attacks. You can do sniffing attacks. And these are the things that open the doors, that control the doors. If they're on your enterprise network, you've basically lost the game. The manufacturers leave in back doors for the installers and the maintainers and maybe others, and they don't document any of them. The only way you could find these back doors is by reverse engineering. And then there are these cards which let you in, prox cards, an early example of RFID tags. They have a short number which is sent by RF to the reader, and these can be read remotely by an attacker. While you're in the elevator, somebody can walk up to you with a battery-powered reader and read the card in your wallet. Maybe if you have two, it would be difficult. But if you only have one card in your wallet, they can read them. Some of these are field programmable, so you can generate your own cards. The low card numbers have problems, and brute force attacks are possible, although I don't know of a brute forcing machine yet. Are these more secure than keys? Maybe. So here's a case study that I did with Mark Chen at a financial institution where we decided it would be fun to break into the badging system, which would gain us access to everything else. I won't name the vendor on the tape, but this system was running SCO Unix on a PC with basically all the services turned on, serial wiring to guard stations. A root password was published in the user manual, R00T. When we called tech support and said, why did you publish your root password? They said, oh, you don't want to change that, you know. That could create big service problems for us. We couldn't support you. Dial-up modems, which they also recommended always be left on. So, of course, I logged on as root and started poking around. It was listening for TCP connections on 21 ports. The source was on the machine. It was open source, but not because they believed in open source. It was for their convenience, so they could compile in features. And so I was looking at IFDEF Jetway, IFDEF US House. I was starting to get alarmed. Other IFDEFs included LDS Church, GE King of Prussia, which I think makes nuclear gadgets or jet engines or something, University of Washington, Corning, U.S. Senate, University of Southern California, Yale University Medical Center, and five airports by name, all the British airports. And their customers included 50 airports, prisons, all the state correctional institutions in Pennsylvania. I was visualizing musical cells. At midnight, we'll just open all the cell doors and see what happens. So looking at the database schema was really instructive because the system has this concept of passkey, a magic word. You type at the guard terminal, and it conveys various privileges. It's like a password, but without a login. And all of these things were in a database table, lightly obfuscated. So, of course, we extracted the passwords, and we noticed there was a special passkey, a magic function of the date, which conveyed system manager privilege to anyone who knew how to compute it. So you could just type in this number, and boom, you were the super user. This was not documented. So, of course, an attacker could do anything, including musical cells, create stealth badges, alter code, disable the logging mechanism, remove or alter the log records. There are general problems with sensors and alarms, which I don't have time to talk about, or Bari won't have time to demo. We won't talk about video, but video has its pluses and minuses. Particularly, you may discover this when the PIN of your ATM card is sniffed by someone who has installed a surreptitious video camera pointed at the keyboard and has put an overlay card reader on the ATM. I'll just talk about this colocation case study. I was hired to test security at a big colo, one run by a publicly held company with vaults. They called them vaults. Cages and cabinets on a raised floor. But the raised floor was the plenum for the cool air, which would flow through the raised floor, go through vents in the vault, and go up into the ceiling. So basically, this was just an enclosed area with an open floor and an open ceiling. Naturally, you could go over the ceiling or under the floor, but they said, we have passive infrared sensors. We're protected by motion sensors in our vault. So I decided to test it. I submarined under the floor, popped up, waved at the motion sensor. 20 minutes later, nothing had happened. So I walked out of the door, and I waved at the camera. I put up a sign saying, Bust me. Nothing happened. I walked out the door with a PC. How did I get in the first place? I walked in the back door, and they buzzed me in because I had a legitimate-looking badge, which I had forged. So, of course, what you find out is that the motion sensor is for their convenience. It's a request-to-exit sensor. It shunts the switch on the door that enables you to leave without setting off the alarm. If you force the door on the way in, it would set off the alarm. But if you're walking out, no alarm. So they didn't ask themselves the question, how could somebody get in the space when nobody entered? There's been nobody in the space for 48 hours, but suddenly there's movement in the space. Isn't that abnormal? Well, no, because they have no integration between the motion sensing and the access control and the alarm. They're all disintegrated systems. Identity, I'll just leave you with one thought question, which is the last bullet here. Is it better for your colo to accept your driver's license or to issue you their own credential containing a shared secret or to check your face in a database? And my claim is that private credentials are much better these days because anybody can make driver's licenses, like this guy who forged the identity. This is Abraham Abdallah, who pled guilty to a large number of counts of forging the identities of 211 of the Fortune 400 richest people a few years ago. The USGAO also has been doing experiments on phony driver's licenses. They determined that if you filled out this form, which asks you questions like, are you a fugitive from justice? Are you subject to a court order restraining you from harassing, stalking, or threatening? Or have you ever been adjudicated mentally defective? If you answer any of these questions yes, well, then you can't get it. But if you answer them all no, and you have a driver's license, or you have something that looks like a valid driver's license, which you can make using stuff on eBay, you can buy stuff like this in the five states with minimum Brady law enforcement. The reason why is they look up your driver's license in a database. And if they don't get a hit, then you must be a good guy. They don't look up the driver's license to determine if it's valid. They look it up to determine if it has the name of a known criminal. What's wrong with this picture? Here are just two more scary devices which will underscore why physical security is important. They're keystroke sniffers. You can buy them for under $100 out of catalogs or on the internet, and they store about half a megabyte of keystrokes. This is why passwords are completely obsolete technology and people should not use them for high-value transactions. I'm way out of time. Barry?
Okay. Okay, then for the last 30 minutes, I'm going to do some demos, and then hopefully some people can ask questions as well. As many people of you know, I'm chairman of the Dutch support group Tool, which is spelled with three O's. It stands for the Open Organization of Lockpickers. And we kiddingly say that the three O's stand for you have to practice over and over and over again to become any good at lockpicking. Which really is true. I mean, at this moment, I'm very, very busy with my business, which is the Cryptophone. That's where I spend most of my time designing a secure phone, which looks like this. It's an open, or the source code is available of this phone. We try to make a phone that is untappable and as secure as possible by publishing the source. And this really takes up a lot of my time. So, unfortunately, I've not been involved in lockpicking for the last 2 years as much as I would like to. Fortunately, a lot of people from Germany and even some from France have helped me collect some nice tricks for you to show. And actually, it's a follow-up of what I did 2 years ago. The video that I did 2 years ago with Mike, who's sitting over there, is still available online. It's being downloaded a lot. It's downloadable for free. If you go to website, if you go to our website www.tool.nl with three O's, T-O-O-O-L.nl, you'll find a link to the free download of all the things that we did last year, and that included the ElectroPic, that included the foiled nimble impression, that included a lot of things. So I'll now focus to some other things that we've been up to. One of the things is that we're being recognized more and more as a serious party, as a serious player by the lock industry. For instance, we have found a severe, very extreme severe vulnerability in a lock that I will demonstrate now. I promised the guys that made the lock, the manufacturer, that I would put a little tape over their brand name because... because there are still a few, a small number of these locks around. But what actually happened is that somebody came into the tool sport evening and said, well, you know, here's this this nice lock and here's the key. And, well, this, of course, works and it operates. But he found that if you insert a blank key and you turn it into, you put it into the lock, you put pressure on it, you take it out, but you leave the tip in, wiggle it a little bit, it's open. Now, this happened at a evening that Mr. Tobias was visiting us and doing a lecture on master keying. And, you know, we all looked at each other and he said, well, you know, this is just a lucky combination of pins and it's a one-thing go. But then we thought about it some more and we discovered that it actually was a vulnerability that applied to all the locks, the complete series of locks ever made in this series. And we figured out what happened. The factory that manufactures these locks actually didn't manufacture all of it. They only did a part of it. What happened is that they bought the locks from a cheaper manufacturer, and when they got the locks, they were completely assembled, but they were filled with all the combination pins 3. So the pins would be all at the same length, 3, 3, 3, 3, 3, and they would have a blank key that looks like that's cut a little bit deeper. There would be a whole line of ladies sitting there with a pinning kit. They would insert the key, they would insert the blank with the 3, turn the plug 180 degrees, remove the plug, re-key the pins with a new combination, for instance 15753, and put it back in. Now, so far there is no vulnerability. But what happened is that the factory that sold the locks used pins, the top pins, of a diameter of 2.2 millimeters. And they replaced the low pins with pins of 2.0 millimeters, which means that they are actually more thin. So the pins that the key touches are more thin than the pins that are on top of it. So if you turn it a little bit, if you put a little tension on it, the gap that normally is 2.3 millimeters goes to 2.0 millimeters, and the pin that's 2.3 millimeters cannot fall down anymore. So I phoned the factory and I said, well, you know, you have a serious problem. And they couldn't believe it. They said, well, you know, it cannot be that with a blank everybody can open this key within 2 seconds without any training. And remember, no physical evidence is there. I mean, when I pick a lock, I make scratches in the lock. And if you send a picked lock to a forensic laboratory, which the German sport group has got some experience with, the German forensic laboratory asked if they could pick some locks and examine them. And they could actually quite detailed explain this lock has picked with an ElectroPic. This is done by hand. This isn't been picked at all. But with this technique, nobody would ever find out. So somebody could rob your complete house. And, you know, you really have tough luck because there's nobody who can prove that you didn't lose a key or problems like that. So that gave us quite some credit to the industry, especially since we came to them. You know, we could have gone to the 8 o'clock news or whatever and make a big fuss out of it, but we didn't do that. We tried to be the good guys. This is such a serious vulnerability that, you know, we tried to... And they immediately closed the factory, and it took them 3 days and a weekend to think what was the best strategy, and they got all the locks back from the shop and et cetera. And, you know, they, yeah, it's they handled it well. Okay, then about the lockpicking itself. I could explain how lockpicking works. I don't know if there's a need for that. How many people would like me to explain in detail why lockpicking is possible and how it can be done? Because it's been told many, many times before. And I will be downstairs at the second floor between 2 and 5. So I'll be there 3 hours teaching everybody who wants to pick locks. As Mark said, we have designed a special, it's already a collector's item, a special pick set. Normally, the pick sets that people carry, are extremely full with all sorts of impressive-looking tools. But the thing is, for lockpicking, you only need actually one tool or two. Or you always need a tensioner and something called the finger or the lifter. And this specific one we made has got two different ends. And this will open, if you spend enough time practicing, this will help you open, I don't dare to say exactly how many percent, but I would say 80% of the locks around you without any problem, as long as you practice. Because the tools don't open the locks, you do. You open the lock. Okay, so if you want to learn to pick locks, just come downstairs between 2 and 5. Tomorrow morning, there's going to be a lockpick championship. We'll put a nice reward on that. We'll put a nice prize on that. Okay. What's that? I'm not exactly sure about the time yet. So.
15 minutes.
Okay, we got 15 minutes. Okay. Well, I brought a whole lot of things to demonstrate. But since we're running a little bit out of time, I will go into the bump key. The bump key, as Mark already explained, is a key that is cut to its lowest position. Sometimes it's even cut a little bit below its lowest position. And what happens is that if you insert it into the lock, of course it will not turn because the pins are not in the right position. What you do is you take out one click, so you remove it a little bit, and then you hit it. I'm not sure if I can do this on camera. Demonstration effect. Open. Okay. Now, I was first shown this technique, was first shown to me actually with a key and a lock in Germany by some of my good friends at the Sportfreunde der Sperrtechnik. And they become really good at it. And the nice thing about this technique is that it can be used on locks like this one. I'm not sure if you can see, but the keyway of this lock, it's an EVA lock, is extremely narrow. It's almost impossible to even get a tool in because it's warded all over the place. It's going zigzag. It's really extremely difficult. But luckily, with the bump key, you know, it's no problem at all, or at least it takes a few blows to open it. If it blows in 2 times. Yeah, it's open. So it just takes a little practice to do it. And as I told you, I didn't have much time to practice. Now, my good friend Oliver Diedrichsen from Germany explained me that this could also be done with dimple keys, with the high secure locks. So, but he also found that if you pull back one full notch, that it doesn't work well. So what he does is, he cuts the keys, or he cuts the cuts in the key a little bit more to the tip of the key, to and this will give you more space. And he made with some with a hot glue stick from a glue gun. He made a what he calls a buffer. And what happens is you insert it in the lock, and you have a little bit of play, but you cannot push it in. You cannot push it in too deep. You can only push it in a little bit. And I'll see if I can open this one. Uh,
making dents in the table. Ow.
Okay, it's open. No, but this is what I mean with if it wasn't with the help from some of my friends of Germany and France, I wouldn't be able to show you all these tricks because I really don't have that much time to really go into nights and nights of playing with all these things. I hope to do it a better prepared job maybe next time. Some trick from France then. There is a Bricard lock, and the Bricard lock is special that the key itself has got two rows of pins next to each other. I don't know if you can see it, but it's a very sophisticated system. And of course you will probably never see a Bricard lock because it's French and but in But in France, this is really a very expensive, high security lock, and to pick it, it's almost virtually impossible because of these two rows of pins, and it's very difficult. But my good friend Jimé Chamary, he's thinking a lot about lock security, and he thought, well, it must be possible to make some sort of impressioning system. And as Mark already put out, with foil tape, you can make some impressioning systems. But with this lock, that seemed not to work. So what he did was he used packaging material, this foamy-like stuff. And he made a blank, which is made out of two parts, actually. This is it uncut, so you can move the parts. And he sticks in this packaging material, and it's really amazing, but it really works. At least I hope it does now. No. Mm-hmm. Demonstration effect kicking in. No, okay. But okay, I'm going to remove it from the camera.
Do you want people to queue up for questions while we're demoing?
Yes. Okay.
Yeah. So while you're doing that, I have a quick question. What kind of locks do you have on your door?
Okay. The reason what is also my daytime job is making sure the physical security of the space around the cryptophone area. I mean, we're making secure phones to keep the bad guys out, but these bad guys have almost unlimited resources. So the thing is, I need to be at a state-of-the-art level of making sure that nobody enters our building without them compromising our computers or the systems that we work on. So I'm not going to tell you. Okay, it's open. It's open. It's turning. But I can tell you that a lot of computer security is involved. It's not only a mechanical system we use. I can tell a little bit. It's funny that
by the way, if you want to harass us with questions, please queue up at the microphone in the center. We only have a few minutes left, but if you want to yell at us with questions or just say harassing comments.
Yeah, one real good secure lock system is by Abloy. It works with disks, and I did open a couple of disk locks the last time from Abbas. But this is actually much more sophisticated. It's got a double locking bar, and if I was to recommend locks, it would probably be the Medico M3, the ASA V10, and the Abloy systems, because these are really the high secure systems. Okay, if you have a question.
Yeah, I have a question about the bump key method. Does that work on the majority of locks?
Yeah, it works on an amazingly amount of locks. The only thing is you need time to practice. You really, you know, if you think you can open any lock with three strikes with the first time you try it, you're wrong. But if you practice with it, you can open a large amount of locks. It works the same as a pick gun. It elevates the pins up. And it's a timing matter as well. So you need to strike, wait a fraction of a second, and then turn. If you turn at the moment that you strike, you're not going to open it. It's really a timing matter. It's really something.
And are there any locks that method doesn't really tend to work on, or because of the style of the lock? Or?
Well, as I said, the Medicos, the Asa V10, the lock with the sidebar, and the Abloy, they're completely resistant against it. Right. It works on a variety of locks. It works on padlocks. It works on door locks. It works on an amazing amount of locks.
Right. Thank you.
You're welcome. My friend Mike.
Hi, Barry. First off, great presentation, guys. But the one thing that I think Mr. Tobias, if that's the right name, he was the only one who really touched on, the fact that locks are one of the weakest links in all of security, and that you can cut through the drywall or go over the walls or under, as he said, in the general feeling of that. Now, considering that, when we talk about this lock has a terrible weakness here and that lock has a terrible weakness there, as a whole security-wide thing, do you really feel the lock is that important to the security chain?
Yes, it is. It still is a point of attack.
Sure.
Yeah, I mean, I think one advantage is that from the attacker's point of view, if you attack the lock, you often leave very little forensic evidence. So one property of the lock, as opposed to punching a hole through the drywall, is that you don't discover the attack until much later. And so, you know, that's one reason that locks are important to study in and of themselves. But it's absolutely true that these are just part of a larger system. And if you're concerned with securing something, you have to look at everything.
Yeah, you really want defense in depth, which means locks, alarms, video, everything.
The key distribution is often a problem. If you can find the facilities guy who's left the key in the coffee cup, well, and then you impression it, then you have forever entry. So it's not the lock that's the problem. It's the way the keys are stored.
Hi. One of the questions that I have focuses more on the kind of like some of the automotive cars where you have the microchip embedded within the key system. Now, as far as the additional spin regarding like tumblers or if there's something else needed to activate the chip so that the lock turns.
There are a bunch of different kinds of those. Some of them are really unsophisticated. Some of the earlier ones, with that computer chip turned out to just be a resistor. And with 15 or 16 different values.
Actually, so that was pretty. It's a pretty good system that's still out there because it's easy.
Right.
And it works.
But some of them have challenge response these days. Yeah. So they're really transponders with RFID. Challenge response is very sophisticated. So the problem is you can't tell what it is. By the way, why do you want to steal cars?
Something about a friend of mine who had misplaced one of his keys, and since it cost about $400 or $500.
Good story.
Exactly. You know, $500 for a replacement key from GM, I mean. Yeah. Well, since he
I'm not sure why you want to deprive those good people at GM of their $500 for your replacement fee.
I don't know.
We have a couple minutes, so please,
okay.
Quickly.
Can we take one more question?
Yeah. Actually, in addition to his, that's the Texas Instruments TIRIS system that they're using. Challenge response-based RFID. I was actually about to ask you about that.
Last question, because we have to be out of here, unfortunately.
SpeedPass system uses the exact same technology. Have any of you gone into any sort of analysis of this?
You can look at Dave Farber's list, interesting people. There has recently been a thread on EasyPass, FastPass, how it works. It's basically a very simple RFID.
I have the equipment to read them down in my room right now.
Say that again?
I have the equipment to read them down in my room right
very
now.
Very good.
Send me an email, would you?
Yes. No problem.
I think let's each take a one-sentence parting shot, since we have to be out of here right now.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, and I hope to see you at the second floor between 2 and 5 today and tomorrow.
Thank you very much.